Thanks for listening to Pop Culture Happy Hour. There are lots of other NPR podcasts, including great interviews, highlights from the week's news, storytelling, and entertainment. Browse them all on iTunes under podcasts. And that's the kicky music that means it is time again for Pop Culture Happy Hour. I'm Linda Holmes. I'm the editor of NPR's pop culture and entertainment blog, Monkey See. This week, while we were all tweeting, Twitter was having its IPO. It seems like as good a time as any to look at what we're doing with 140 characters these days. Then on the heels of a new Sundance show being broadcast in French with subtitles, we'll talk about processing entertainment you read while you're watching it. And as always, we'll close with what's making us happy this week. Before we get started here in historic Studio 44, let's go around the table. Stephen Thompson, what do you do at NPR?
I am a writer and editor with NPR Music.
And Trey Graham, what do you do at NPR?
I cover movies and theater and that sort of thing.
It's true. Glenn Weldon this week is off reading Fred Schneider's Twitter feed, I'm guessing. And with us in Glenn's stead is our pal who actually, I was not here the last time we had our guest in the studio, but we are here with Audie Cornish. NPR's Audie Cornish.
Hey,
Audie. Another bit of estrogen for the room.
Audie Cornish, when you're not appearing on Pop Culture Happy Hour...
What am I doing with my life?
Do you have another job at NPR that we might have heard of?
Hardly. I co-host our afternoon program, All Things Considered.
We're always happy to be able to borrow audio away from actual news.
No, that's okay. So am I.
So speaking of actual news, last week Twitter had their IPO. So in a lot of business terms that I don't completely and fully understand, they went out there, people bought stock. Now everybody's waiting to see it settle out and figure out how much money Twitter, which has never turned a profit,
right.
Is worth.
Right. So this is the week that people who have previously been in the habit of saying, what in goodness name is that for, had to face the decision of whether or not to actually throw money at it.
Right. It's true. It's true. And I was fascinated by the fact that everyone seemed to understand that the valuation of Twitter was coming from kind of nothing. It was coming from kind of the ether, even more than usual.
People have gotten so much savvier about internet IPOs, right? And even if you didn't know much, I think Facebook's IPO last year really kind of taught people something. They're not sure, but they know to be careful.
Yeah, lessons of one kind or another.
Yeah, I'm sitting there like, I thought of a quip. How can I monetize this?
Well, because the thing about, and there was also a big book about Twitter that just has come out about the formation of Twitter.
Yes, Nick Bilton's Hatching Twitter. We talked to him.
Mm. Yeah. How was that?
It was great.
Audie, bring in the knowledge of things.
No. In the actual reportage.
How was that thing on the radio that apparently I didn't hear?
No, I don't expect you to hear it all. Okay, so Hatching Twitter. What was interesting about the book is they talked to each of the founders, and Nick Bilton, the guy who wrote it, said what was fascinating is each founder had a different idea about what Twitter is for. If you talk to one, it was to spread news about yourself. If you talk to another, it was about to talk about your surroundings. They're not even sure what it's for.
Right.
So good luck, investors. Right.
And I thought it was just to notify me of school closings.
Right. Well, and you can see how in the relatively short life of Twitter, I mean, in terms of a cultural phenomenon, we're talking about less than 10 years.
Mm-hmm. Right?
Right.
And in that short time, it's become, you know, it is a place where people talk about themselves. And, you know, the kind of people who never use Twitter who say, I don't need to hear what you had for breakfast, like vastly overestimate the importance of breakfast on Twitter. But there are breakfast tweeting people.
There are
breakfast tweeters. There are cocktail tweeters. Here's a picture of the drink I'm drinking.
There are rage tweeters.
There are news tweeters.
There are. Oh, my God. The news tweeters were obsessed. I actually think this is a big thing about Twitter is that journalists are on it and we're obsessed with it. And so things that happen on Twitter that are trends, quote unquote, you'll notice become news stories very quickly.
Very quickly.
Anchor says, everyone's talking about a thing. And then later on, you're like, wait a second, it was just Twitter. You know, like,
it does speed up the echo chamber nature of a lot of these communities.
It does.
In good ways, because there are, I've I've had times where I thought, oh, there's really interesting discussion going on about race and culture that has, like, flown straight to the mainstream in a way that it wouldn't before, right? I mean, especially when I think about Black Twitter, as they call it, mm-hmm. like, the conversations you would have had way back when in your house, at church, at the barbershop, whatever, now is on Twitter, and you can, you know, get to that TV show creator or whoever and get their ear and say, hey, we don't like this.
And absolutely. Berate him viciously
Same
until he quits
women,
Twitter.
Right? The well, sort of young true. Feminist movement on yeah. online, I mean, they're very propelled by Twitter.
It's lovely. You know, as somebody who writes about gender issues relatively frequently, it is really nice. And they're not all women. There are men who fall into this category as well. But it is really nice to know that when you're on Twitter, there is kind of this group of people who sort of are going to not let you feel like you're flapping around in the wind mm-hmm. by yourself when you say something that might be controversial. And as difficult as Twitter can be when controversy is kind of swirling around you, it can also be really helpful to have those people who are kind of allies who are like, hey, you know, I heard what you were trying to say. And, you know, I think this too.
It can also dig people further into their trenches, though.
That's true.
Having a certain... Because one thing I always say about Twitter is that Twitter is whatever you want it to be. You were
right.
saying about breakfast tweeters, and we were joking about race tweeters. You find your community, and you follow mm-hmm. your community. My community on Twitter, I follow 140 people, and they are largely my friends. I know almost all of the
right.
140 people that I follow on Twitter. And I think that Twitter does have a way of backing up and forming a little bit of an echo chamber because you choose the people you follow somewhat
right.
based on the fact that they're the kind of people you want to listen to. And I do
right.
think people sometimes get dug farther and farther and farther into their pre-existing positions, which is true of a lot of things.
It can absolutely have a siloing effect. But I think one of the things that is the genius of the retweet, and this is way oversimplifying, but you know, if somebody in your silo retweets something or comments on something you've said, then that reaches a population that you don't know often.
Mm-hmm. Oh, right,
and,
sure.
And so then occasionally you'll get a sort of from left field flyby comment from somebody and you'll go, oh, that's a fascinating person. Let me look more into their life and their community. Twitter, for me, has become a source of information, a source of comfort sometimes, which is fascinating to me.
We talked about this last week with Cat Chow's Cat.
Yeah.
Right, yeah. I think it's and I think you said then or she said then that you know, with all the ugliness that's out there on the internet, I'm actually surprised by how infrequently I get drawn into unpleasant conversations on
yeah.
Twitter.
Well, the nice thing about them is you can't always kind of opt out of them.
Oh, absolutely.
To a degree.
And
I
you
mean,
can have an itchy blocking finger.
Mm-hmm.
You
right.
know, there are trolls on Twitter and there's bullying on Twitter.
Yeah.
But there's also a little button that lets you block people who are jerks.
I used
yeah.
to almost never block people, and now I block people still quite rarely.
I've actually blocked Trey.
Nice.
He was on some vacation someplace nice and I was
mm-hmm.
like,
well, I think one discussion that's gone round and round and round a bunch of times is kind of, Audie was talking about the appeal of Twitter for journalists. And one thing that a lot of traditional journalists have struggled with is that concept that it's not supposed to be about you, right? You're not supposed to have, I mean, I've talked to a lot of journalists who are like, I don't want to have a persona.
Yeah.
I don't want to have a personality.
Definitely
I don't need people to like
I know
me.
Do it or into branding.
Right. And it's that weird thing about that tension between you want it to still be about the story, but in the current environment, it helps you get to people to tell them the story if they like you and trust you.
Mm-hmm.
And it's complicated in that way.
Well, here's how two ways that journalists are grabbing towards it. Number one is to have an ongoing conversation with the people you cover. So there's a lot of like Republican Democratic staffers and strategists who go back and forth with the journalists all day. So in effect, the public is getting to watch a conversation that would normally happen in a hallway or quote unquote in a cloakroom.
Right.
You're seeing the back and forth of like, you said it was this, but is it really that? And there's a little one-upmanship going on. And then the other thing is newsroom banter. So all those hashtag games, right, that
right.
you
mm-hmm.
see for other things,
yep.
we do them as journalists. You know, a popular one is why Obama is late, because he's always late to press conferences. And there will be a Twitter game that will go on for the 10 minutes while we're all waiting where people are giving all the reasons why he might be late.
Yeah.
I actually brought one because I thought it would be funny. But one was he's trying to log on to healthcare.gov.
Oh.
Got a lot of retweets.
Bam!
Another one was on E-Trade buying gold.
nice.
Heavens. But, you know, the hashtag game, I'm glad you brought up hashtag
yeah.
games, because when you talk about how Twitter, when it was founded, seemed to have this variety of purposes in the minds of its founders. To me, one of the few actual art forms that I think has come out of Twitter that is a genuinely different kind of comedy, like a well-executed hashtag.
Yeah.
Is a different kind of comedy, because sometimes it's this juxtaposition of the hashtag and the joke that really makes and builds the joke. And that is something that I think didn't really exist until Twitter.
No,
and
not at all. Try reading one out loud to a friend. You know when you do that? You, like, see a good hashtag game,
right,
and you turn to the person next to you, and you're like, and then they said this, hashtag strange. And they're just like, I don't know what that means.
Doesn't
I don't
work.
Know why you're still talking.
And it sounds, whenever you read tweets
as soon as you say the word hashtag.
You sound like you are. Have you ever seen the old clip of Bryant Gumbel on the Today Show talking about the internet?
Yes.
There's this one where he was like, I don't know what this is. They're like, I guess you put a dot in this.
See, there it is. Violence at NBC, GE, com. I mean,
well, Allison should know.
What is
the
internet
about, Allison?
Anyway?
Internet is that massive computer,
right,
network, the one that's becoming really big now.
What do you mean? That's big? How does one? What do you write to it, like mail?
It's a great clip. We'll link to it because it's awesome.
It is the series of tubes of newsmen,
right?
And whenever you say hashtag, you are Bryant Gumbel.
It's true.
Okay.
I will tell you, it's entered the culture enough,
yeah,
that I have seen it deployed successfully in a theatrical production. I've seen, yeah, an actor manage to deliver a hashtag joke in the middle of a scene that was, had a lot else going on. But still.
There's also hashtag rap, I feel like, right? It's that idea of you say a lyric, a clever thing, and then you just say one word at the end that's supposed to sum it all up. I'll let someone else find an example of this.
And when you're listening to it, you don't see them making the hashtag mark with their forefingers and drawing them across to make a plus sign with their hand.
To make
Wolverine
the hashtag
scratches.
Yeah. The Wolverine scratches, indeed.
Exactly.
Yeah, I mean, because I can't imagine that you could have really envisioned, or like the way Rob Delaney uses Twitter,
yeah,
if you follow Rob Delaney, like these bizarre kind of surreal jokes, where many of which are completely filthy, but he'll just tweet them like at Walmart or something like that,
and McDonald's,
and it's not. I can't imagine that when you invented Twitter, you could have thought maybe someone will tweet random filthy things to Walmart in the voice of a person who barely can type. Like, you wouldn't think of that. Like, you wouldn't think that's what my great invention is for.
Well, and the number of satirical accounts and then responses to satirical accounts, and you go down this bizarre rabbit hole. I mean, Glenn has talked on this show, you know, in the past about, like, peanut-free mom.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. who is the
magnificent ongoing piece of performance art that is Tilda Swinton.
Yeah,
yeah,
the person pretending to be Tilda,
right,
Swinton,
yeah,
and out Tilda Swintoning Tilda Swinton. But then, and you know, and then the way that it goes into these, you know, accounts that are responding to accounts and people who are then drawn in, and yeah, the number of things on Twitter that manage to still be non-satirical, I feel like is non-self-aware is dwindling.
Yeah.
Like how many sincere uses of hashtag beast mode and hashtag YOLO
and thug life.
Thug life remain on Twitter that are not, you know, me talking about eating cream of wheat in my underwear at 2 a.m. and crying.
Was that YOLO or Thug Life?
That was YOLO and Thug Life and Beast Mode.
I have to admit, YOLO is one where a well-deployed YOLO hashtag,
yep,
will make me laugh. Yep. And I just feel like I don't really know why.
Well, because it also works in real life. If you say YOLO out loud and someone asks what it is, everyone still laughs. There are other hashtags that just don't work when they come off of the screen.
Well, there was a list one time. Do you remember the incident where a story went around that Justin Bieber had peed in a bucket, like in a custodian's bucket while he was at some at venue? And somebody wrote like a list of like 20 reasons why Justin Bieber might have done this. And one of them was YOLO. And it really did. It's such a weird little
punctuation at this point, and it's
a
hilarious,
surprisingly sturdy little string of characters. I do think you bring up Justin Bieber peeing in a bucket. And
speaking of which,
aren't you glad you joined us, Audie?
I just want to hear the segue.
No, the notion of what Twitter is for, at least for me, and I can only speak for myself, is that Twitter is good for stupid crap. that Twitter is good. We talked about this a little bit, I think, when we were talking about the VMAs, that I was saying, like, Twitter is for the VMAs. Mm-hmm. Twitter is for, the panda has escaped.
Yes.
Twitter is, for me, is much, much tricky when you get into things that are serious.
Yeah.
When you get into national tragedies, when you get into Newtown, when you get into even things like elections almost, you know, things that are of serious import. Twitter, for me, loses a lot of its reason for being. And I think, though, that when you have these communities that form or that pop up around silly things that everyone is watching on TV, or just little memes that pop up, that's where Twitter has so much more joy and so much more, I think, value.
Well, and I think you're right. You hit on the right word. Twitter is better when it's indulging in joy. When people find some common spark all at once, it's about the distributed shared experience of watching things like the VMAs. I've been pleased to see that in times of crisis, there are some sort of emerging norms. I saw a hashtag the last time around that was like, don't tweet the scanner, right?
Oh, yeah.
Don't repeat the rumors you're hearing on Twitter when something like the Navy Yard shooting has just happened.
Yeah, you get a common decency will sometimes pop up on Twitter.
Sometimes bubble up.
But I also think that in the spirit of things like the VMAs, I also think Twitter is only good for pretend outrage, like, and not real outrage. Like, Twitter is great for...
All my outrage is real, Thompson.
And I have my real outrage. And when I'm truly outraged, first of all, it's good for many reasons that I don't take to Twitter. But also, like, if a Green Bay Packers quarterback, whoever it might be on a given week, is throwing an interception, that's what Twitter is for. But if
are you suggesting that the rage you feel when the Packers play badly is not real?
But it's
I can name light bulbs in your house that feel differently about that.
But you know what I'm saying. That for things, it's good for outrage over things that don't really
matter.
No,
I know.
Well, look, I'm going to challenge you on this. Yes, it's difficult in the area of social networking sometimes to express emotions that are darker, right? Without going overboard or dramatic or seeming to undercut the very thing that you're trying to pay tribute to in some way. But basically, Twitter is this ongoing conversation. And in an era when we're constantly, in the media, hand-wringing about there not being a water cooler anymore, or there not being everyone gathering around the radio or the TV, this sense of gathering. Twitter is a constant stream where even if you've time shifted and put everything in your whole life on demand, if you put in the hashtag for scandal, you're in it. You're in the ongoing conversation. If you put in the hashtag, for the storm in the Philippines, you're in it. You're going to hear what's going on and you will be somewhat up to date. Now, I think news-wise, are people... Is the crowdsourcing kind of learning how to do news on it? Yes, and it's clearly trial and error.
Yeah.
But in a way, that's a good thing because people are demanding a lot from journalists right now. And, look how it is when you do it. It's tough, right? It's hard. It's not easy. You've got to verify. Right. There's all kinds of things going on. And I think we're collectively learning how to use it as a tool.
Another group that I think has a huge challenge from Twitter that I don't think we should neglect to mention is comedians.
Yeah.
That I think Twitter has drastically changed the face of comedy and drastically changed the way people do comedy. And I think it is – I haven't done any studies on this. I'm pulling this completely out of my rear end. But that the rise of the comedian who is a writer – versus the comedian who has and obviously you comedians can still have people write jokes for them and they put them on Twitter, but I feel like the comedians who thrive on Twitter, the comedians who have really your Patton Oswalt's, your Rob Delaney's, are writers, and they're people who are full, their heads are just full of jokes, and that jokes just come out of them whether they almost involuntarily. Those are the people who are able to take advantage of Twitter in the way that comedians used to. I think it's changed. I think it's shifted much more toward writers, is what I'm saying.
And I do think before we get off this topic, I do want to say that as Audie was saying, it is hard to talk about serious topics on Twitter, and those conversations can be really challenging. But there are also people. I mean, we've had Gene Demby on this show from NPR a bunch of times, and he undertakes very serious, very difficult conversations on Twitter all the time. And I think you can look at that and say it requires enormous patience. It requires an enormous amount of sorting through responses that aren't productive. Yeah. But if you have that patience and if you have that kind of desire to do it that way, you can sometimes get to these really interesting exchanges, especially if you kind of can throw open a question that's not antagonistic. It's just a question asking for people's experience. And you can get to some important and helpful. I mean, he opened a conversation last week about whether people had ever been profiled and followed in stores in the wake of the story about Barney's. And I think those responses were fascinating to me. And reading them was really felt like a service, I felt. So,
when we talk about writers and Twitter, we talk about comedians as writers and their experience on Twitter, I wanted to point to what I thought was an interesting New York Magazine essay by the author Catherine Schultz. She writes about it. You know, it's fun that we've been sort of trying to define the cultural experience of Twitter, because she says Twitter, trying to talk about it, puts me in the position of being the blind man at the zoo, or the blind man and the elephant, really the blind man at the Bronx Zoo, not even knowing what animal I'm trying to grapple with. I can't tell you anything at all, she writes, about what Twitter looks like elsewhere or in the aggregate. I can only tell you what it looks like to me. That rang really true to me. The other thing she said that I thought was fascinating about why good writers are attracted to Twitter and why it works well for them is that it is basically what writers do. It is the act of putting words to thought and experience in real time.
It also imposes a discipline on writers. Right. And a lot of writers like writing with a certain amount of discipline.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I used to, for the longest time, I used to try to tweet in exactly 140 characters.
Mm-hmm.
I was the same way when text messages were limited to 160 characters. Mm-hmm. I would try to text in, you know, I'm sure it's a personality disorder of some kind. but I think that in a way it's a little bit like haiku, where the rules are part of what make it fun.
Well, and for me, as a writer who has a tendency, because I have a blog, to kind of write without any...
To gas on endlessly, I think is what you're looking for.
No, to write without regard for length. It definitely, especially when I first got on Twitter, and this still happens to me, like I'll write something and I'll think, this is the right way to say this thing or make this joke, but I'm 20 characters over out of 140, which is substantial. And then I'll realize it's actually quite easy to cut out 20 characters. And I think, boy, my writing is full of unnecessary letters. So I don't know.
I do think there's a lot of tension between what writers do, writers who try to write in longer forms, novelists. Again, the Catherine Schultz essay, she talks about what a rich community Twitter has been for her, but how fragmented it has made her thinking, and how it's maybe a challenge to her as a writer of longer form work.
Yeah. Well, I just enjoy getting to know lots and lots of different people.
Absolutely.
And, you know, because I figure if you've tweeted back and forth with someone a bunch of times, it's like you practically know them.
That's right.
You're practically friends.
And then you show up at their wedding and they're like, who are you?
Well, you do find yourself sometimes saying like, oh, yeah, I mean, I don't know her, but I know her from Twitter.
Yeah.
And then you kind of feel like, well, that's strange, but sure, fine, absolutely. And speaking of knowing people through Twitter and other forms of social media, you should come and find us on Facebook at facebook.com/PCHH or on the blog at npr.org/PCHH. And tell us what you think about Twitter and what you think about forming relationships and having difficult conversations and whatever else floats your fancy. About Twitter. I don't know if you can float your fancy.
I don't think you can float fancy. I don't know if fancy.
But I like it.
You should
floats.
Give the hashtag now.
It is. Hashtag float your fancy. No, it's hashtag PCHH, you know, as it would be, as you would think it would be. Although we do not do as much Twitter as we do Facebook in terms of the official show. But we're out there. And speaking of sometimes challenging conversations, the other thing we were going to talk about this week is about an entirely different kind of challenging conversation. The Sundance Channel has just begun showing a French show called, which in English is titled The Returned, which originally people were...
Actually, in France, it's called Le Return. Sorry.
Wow.
I withdraw my comment.
Can I make a poutine joke now?
It originally, when people started talking about it, they were saying it was a show about zombies. But clearly, this is not zombies in the World War Z terrifying zombies. They are people who have returned from the dead. But one of the things that has come up about this show is that it's still relatively rare for American television, even American cable, to show a television show from another country that is subtitled. Typically, our approach is to remake it in English. That's what happened with The Bridge and, plenty of other, and The Killing and plenty of others.
When we decided on this as a topic, I did some thinking about it, and I was thinking about, you know, cultural artifacts and pop cultural artifacts that come to us from other language. And I got telenovelas, Japanese game shows, which more often than not just inspire remakes on the broadcast networks, Canadian comedy, which is its own kind of foreign. but beyond that, I really kind of hit a wall. And so when you were talking about subtitles, I eventually tipped over into, you know, my fallbacks, theater and opera, because this is kind of uncharted territory for television.
It is for television. I mean, I realize as soon as I started to think about it, I've seen tons of subtitled movies more and more in the last few years as I've been going to festivals and stuff like that. But subtitled television is actually very uncommon here. And I think it's very common in other places, but it's uncommon here.
Well, people are so much more familiar with our vernacular and even some of our cultural references. I mean, America so exports its culture, right? And sometimes with TV, it's an intimate medium in the kind of writing you can do, and maybe the perception is those things don't translate so well. I mean, I don't want to defend the industry because I think this is a lame practice, and give me a break. Like, they're constantly remaking British television shows. Like, it's not that hard. Like, we're all speaking English
here. Clearly, it's not just the subtitles.
Exactly. So I welcome this.
Yeah. And I think when I was thinking about movies, the thing that's different to me about movies and television, and I think Thompson will hear me on this because of the way that he watches television and the way that he's often talked about watching television. Mm-hmm. So when you're watching a movie and you're watching a subtitled movie, you're giving it all your attention already. So the fact that you're looking at it and you're having to follow it by reading...
You just took away the thing I was going to say.
Well, why don't you say it then?
Okay. What Linda just said. No, that it does require a different level of concentration. I joke sometimes about subtitled movies that it's the culture's way of forcing me to read, and I really don't appreciate it. but, you know, a lot, it's very easy, you know, with TV in particular, to drift around the room. If you're at the movie theater, you are... You know, one would imagine giving the movie your complete
attention.
You're
not sorting the mail.
You're not sorting the mail. But if you're sorting the mail and up on screen, they're speaking in a language that you don't speak, you are completely and utterly lost.
Right.
And as a side note, you know, I've watched a number of subtitled movies. I've also watched a number of dubbed movies and greatly prefer subtitling to dubbing. Even when we're talking about animated movies like the Miyazaki movies, which, you know, Hayao Miyazaki's made all these wonderful children's movies, and which where all of a sudden you have this very distinct visual stamp that Miyazaki these movies have, and then all of a sudden it's like Tina Fey is talking and it just doesn't feel it doesn't feel right, even though obviously I understand why they can't subtitle all of Miyazaki's movies and market them to 4-year-olds.
In the news department, when there's a voiceover in a foreign news story to all you NPR listeners, you must love when it's like there's a rickshaw driver somewhere and like the guy who speaks though sounds like he's from Indiana. Yeah, he probably is. It's like a guy in the newsroom.
Our producer Nick Fountain was pointing to himself through the window while you said that. I think I've done one of those
voices in the building is one of the perks of working here. At some point, you will play
a voiceover.
Foreign person in an inappropriate story, and you will try and imbue it with so little feeling that no one will think you're interpreting it.
I think I voiced the translation for like a French person, and they're like, Stephen, you do not need to say oh, at the end of
ever
it.
Ever again, actually.
Yeah. Ever again.
Ever. Yeah. Well, it's funny because when I was a high school student, I spent a little bit of time on an exchange program in Spain. And I was there during the time that Full Metal Jacket was out. Mm-hmm. And also The Untouchables. And I saw both of those dubbed in Spanish. Mm. And I realized that when I saw those movies later, I had this sense that I had seen like half of them. Like, because I had sort of...
Right.
I mean, my Spanish was good enough that I could follow along mostly. But yet it took a while to figure out that first of all, the translations weren't always entirely literal. There were things that were a little different in the actual spoken English. And there were also things that I just didn't feel like I picked up well at all in a dubbed movie. And it was really, that was one of the better experiences of that trip, was getting that feeling of like, what's it like to watch a dubbed movie where it would have been in English, but I'm seeing it in Spanish.
I have had that experience but live in a theater. There's a Spanish language theater company here in Washington, D.C. called Teatro Gala. And years ago, they don't do it anymore. Years ago, they used to give you a headset as you walked in if you weren't a Spanish speaker. And they had live actors in a booth reading a script. Huh. Now, what they didn't tell you is that those actors were volunteers, and they had maybe confronted the script 15 minutes before the performance.
Ooh.
So sometimes what you would get was fluid and on point, and sometimes what you would get was several pages behind. And you could hear them flipping pages madly trying to keep up. And it was the most fascinating thing, because I'm a critic, and I'm there trying to assess what's happening on stage, and I've got this hugely distracting English going on in my head. They later changed to a surtitles system where they project the titles above the stage. And Stephen, if you think you resent the effort required to watch a subtitled movie, try
to not get to look at the actors while you're reviewing a play.
Try going up and down from the surtitles to the actors while also listening for meter and rhyme in classical Spanish plays and assessing performances. I would come out and my head would just be pounding.
Yeah.
I almost feel like, how could you even adequately review something?
Well, and the thing is,
they're
presenting these plays to a mixed audience, and we used to say that we would like, I can't do this, I can't do justice to your play, and they would say, no, we want everyone to come see these plays.
Sure,
right.
So
you
end up just representing the experience you have.
And the truth of the matter is,
the comfort of the seats.
This is the direction of culture is globalization, as with everything else, globalization, multilingual outlets and networks and stuff like that. And I, you know, as somebody who writes about pop culture, I've often thought if they gave me like 3 months and they said, go off and do something that you think would be of value, you know, a 3-month sabbatical, the absolute best thing I could do to make myself better at my job would be to reinvigorate my Spanish that I used to be able to speak, because given the way the world is right now and the amount of progress that's been made in increasing the amount and quality of Spanish language entertainment that's available through traditional American media, that would probably be the best thing I could do.
Well, and not to mention the sheer ratings force that is Univision, which beats a lot of English language networks a lot of the time.
It's
not uncommon at all for it to be right up there with, you know, above one or two broadcast networks, English language broadcast networks.
We're only going
to
see more and more of this sort of thing. Univision is launching Fusion, which is an English language channel, but I can't help but imagine there's going to be some back and forth as audiences, you know, sort of intersect. And we're already seeing it, whether you know it or not. You're seeing the movie you see this weekend will be shaped, most likely, by the fact that the studios are making it to be distributed overseas, and they're tweaking the formulas so that they can dodge some of the things we've been talking about. What will translate? Right. What don't you have to subtitle?
Right. And this is I'm a little bit spoilering the thing that's making me happy this week, but I have been reading Linda Obst's book. She worked at Paramount for a really long time in development and has produced a bunch of movies. And she was talking in this book about this very thing, that there are certain things that are assumed to not translate, including sort of comedies of manners and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. And she talked about, for example, there are also, you can look at it either way, American movies that don't translate overseas, or movies from overseas that make a gazillion dollars, but there's no sense that it would in any way mean anything to an American audience, because it's very much about the specific, like what's considered funny in that particular culture, which can be very different depending on where you are.
Well, yeah, look at a movie like Pacific Rim, which came out here and was considered a bit of a non-starter in box office and made, I believe, $500 million in China alone?
Yeah, I don't think they're upset about that movie's
price. Yeah, I think you may see a Pacific Rim too, but you're also starting to see more and more foreign language films opening and doing good business here.
Right.
I mean, as the demographics of this country change, the fact that a movie like Instructions Not Included has made $45 million in the U.S., just the U.S. alone, that is a movie, an import that is a hit because it is appealing to large numbers of people in this country.
Yeah, and I think there's only going to be, I suspect more of this.
Definitely,
as we go.
There'll be more.
Well,
of
in
it.
Some ways, it's good. When we talked to the director of Pacific Rim, Guillermo del Toro, he talked about how much fun it was for him to have a multicultural cast.
Right.
And in a big budget movie, having the big hero not necessarily be, you know, kind of a Tom Cruise figure, being Idris Elba. Is an exciting thing. And the flip side of that, of course, is like you guys said, all of the smaller films the family dramas and the like kind of minor thrillers, those don't get that same kind of attention and love. They can't be made into tent poles in the same way, which is what they're looking for the overseas market.
And yeah, I think right. I can't wait to see what kind of business August Osage County does.
Oh, that's a great point.
That's a great example. It's not going to mean the same thing.
Because I do think like you're going to see like one of the effects of that you're going to see is a squeezing out, I think, of a lot of mid-budget movies. Mm-hmm. I think you're going to see, I think, more and more in the direction of there are X number of movies that cost $150 million to make, and there are Y number of movies that cost less than $5 million to make.
It's in horror with these like Paranormal Activity and stuff like that. And The Purge was even like that.
Yeah, and those, oh man, I mean, that's a whole other topic, but talk about your moneymakers.
Well, right. If you can make it for micro budget and, you know, expectations are much lower about how much cash you have to rake in. But I suspect we're going to see a lot more of this across the board in movies and in television and stuff like that. And I, you know, the other thing that was interesting about this Sundance show, kind of a bit of a digression, but the other thing that's interesting about the Sundance show is that I realized how completely reliant I've become on everything being on demand, because it was on and I knew it was on, but I figured like I'll go back and catch that. And I think I will be able to eventually, but it's not on any of my on demand kind of on demand services. And I realized that I'm just lost. I don't.
Well, Sundance wants you to call up and ask for Sundance.
Well, I get Sundance. Okay. You know what I mean? I can watch it if I, you know, I got to look it up on my thing
and schedule it
and DVR it. But I don't even do that anymore. I'm so lazy that I don't even want to set my DVR anymore.
That is how quickly the cultural norm shifts. I was an early adopter. I had the first TiVo box, and now my TiVo box is sitting unrepaired. And I'm like you. I do everything on demand.
This is how we wind up in WALL-E.
Yep.
This is like step three on the path to WALL-E.
On the recliners with the milkshakes.
Just wanting everything on demand. Like, I can't even be bothered to program a DVR.
Like what? I have to flick my eyelid twice to get the TV I want?
This is a little bit the Louis C.K. Everything is great. Mm-hmm. No one's happy. Thing about how, you know, no matter how great the technology becomes.
That was one of the greatest rants of all time.
Yeah. And we'll link to that, too.
Yeah. The bit about, was it internet on an airline? Yeah. It took 10 minutes for the person to be disgruntled about it.
Right.
It's true. It's true, and I am now that person. I was like, why isn't this Sundance show on demand? I want to press a button on my television, but I'm gonna be finding it on my DVR because I'm willing to do the work. And that brings us to our final segment. What is making us happy this week, Stephen Thompson? What is making you happy this week, sir?
Couple of things. Over the weekend, I became the last person on the entire planet of Earth to watch the movie Anchorman, I literally felt like I was the last. And the entire time I'm watching it, I was actually able. There were lines in that movie I was able to anticipate, based on how thoroughly they have permeated
the Simpsons, and
you know, I realized watching it, among other things, that my colleague Robin Hilton, co-host of All Songs Considered, has never said anything original in his entire life, or at least his entire life post 2004, when Anchorman came out, because everything that Robin has ever said that I thought was funny was simply reciting things from Anchorman. It's a fun movie. I think it's notable primarily just for how much it has permeated everything. Mm-hmm. But I wanted to see it to prepare, obviously, for the sequel that is coming out. The other thing that is making me
I thought you were saying to say for me being here.
Yes, it was preparing me for Audie Cornish.
What would it be like to work with
me? What would it be like to work for somebody who thinks she's that much of a big deal? Stay classy. Stay classy, Cornish.
Ron Burgundy / Audie Cornish.
I get that a lot.
Yeah.
It's the mustache.
It's the mustache.
It is the mustache.
Oh,
yeah.
Radio joke. Radio-based joke.
Sorry, Mom.
The other thing making me happy this week is, you know, we talked a few episodes ago about popular culture that makes us cry and things that always get under our skin and always make us cry. And I discovered a new one last night, which is footage of loved ones being reunited with returning veterans.
Oh, yeah.
Which I gather is a thing. I mean, when I mentioned it on Twitter, well, I mean, I know it's a thing that veterans are reunited with their loved ones, but that montages.
Right. I know what you mean.
And I had never seen a television montage of families being reunited with their loved ones. And I spent the entire time just bawling.
Have you ever seen the ones where they're reunited with their dogs?
With the dogs, and the dogs go bazoo.
And several people have pointed that out to me, and I will be finding them on YouTube the next time I'm not around anyone else.
Yeah.
This particular montage that I saw was set to the song Home by Chris Daughtry.
Sure. Oh.
And I was trying to think, like, what, how much would I have
not
to...
Not Home by Philip Phillips?
Not Home by Philip Phillips, different Idol alum. And I was trying to think, like, how bad would a song have to be to make me not cry while it is accompanying footage of veterans being reunited?
Yeah, what's the threshold for Brechtian distancing?
Yeah, like if there were, if there was footage of veterans being reunited with their loved ones and it was set to Yakety Sax, I would still just blubber. And I realized that the thing that makes me happier more than anything else and makes me cry more than anything else is this, like, good people being rewarded for their sacrifice. And that is an absolutely overwhelmingly emotional thing to witness, is just good things happening to people to whom you owe a debt.
Yeah.
And I, if I watched it for an hour, I would be dehydrated.
Yeah. Aw, you big-hearted lug, you. Trey Graham, what is making you happy this week,
well,
sir?
I'm going to follow that with something every bit as classy. I caught up with Thor last night, so what's making me happy is Blonde and Muscles and that sort of thing. And the Sherman Twitter account, which said, "We've always been Asgardians," and then was immediately taken down.
I did like it, though.
There is a stage version of The Princess Bride in the works. Again, in the works, I should say. There was, for a while, there was a musical version kicking around with music by Adam Gettle, who wrote Light in the Piazza and a couple of other things that I like. That one fell apart. This one is backed by Disney and has the imprimatur of William Goldman, who wrote the book and the screenplay. So this one sounds like it's going to happen. We don't know what form it will take yet. We don't know whether it will make us happy when it gets here, but it is in the works. So that makes for a little frisson.
I forgot to say that.
He's classed up the joint.
And while I was away from you in New York City last week seeing theater, I saw a bunch of stuff that I hope to talk about on Weekend Edition, but I also got to catch up with a slightly older show. It opened back in the spring. It's called Buyer and Seller, and it's a solo show, a fictional solo show, they are keen to stress, about a guy who supposedly works in the shopping mall that not fictionally exists in Barbra Streisand's basement. It is a very funny show. It's got some heart. It's got some warmth about Barbra Streisand, oddly enough. But mostly it is this fantastic performing showcase for Michael Urie, who you'll remember from Ugly Betty, and who is as good as he was on that show, I thought, in his element, in a small theater working a crowd of about 150, 200 people, making personal connections with everybody in that room and selling a very precise kind of comedy that was just, after 8 or 9 months of doing it, still just on. He's just on, and he's amazing. So Buyer and Seller, it's down at the Barrow Street Theater in the Village, I guess.
Wonderful. Thank you, Trey Graham.
Cool.
Audie Cornish, other than being compared to Ron Burgundy, what's making you happy this
week?
What
else is there? Well, let me see. Jumping off of Trey, I'm going to say news that they're turning Alanis Morissette's album Jagged Little Pill into a Broadway musical. Now, for those of you who fall into the in-between generation, too young for X, and you know you're not a millennial, this is, like, a seminal moment, okay?
This is for you what talk of a Hocus Pocus musical is for people a little bit younger.
That's true, because I don't know what those words mean. But this, but Alanis Morissette and this album, so big if you were, like, in high school at the time. So I don't know much about Broadway musicals, but on it. And then in other lady news, there was this thing online. I don't know if any of you guys know Rookie Mag. It is run by Tevi Gevinson. She is this, like, sort of teenage, I don't know what she is in this day and age, celebrity, feminist, young person who has things.
Entrepreneur.
Yeah, I mean, it's
media
insane.
Titan.
She's pretty fantastic.
Yeah.
So she commissioned this interview between Mindy Kaling and Lena Dunham. I know. Now, the reason why this excites me is not because I'm, like, in love with all of these people, but because these are two women who get a lot of crap, right? People think that they're precious or egotistical or whatever it is. But for this teenage girl, she only sees them as comedy showrunners. And that they're cool and that they're in the business and they're doing a thing and I want to hear them talk. And I think every once in a while it's nice to have that little step back that's like, let me take all my weird internet baggage out of my head for a second and appreciate sort of how far whatever your community is, kind of sort of how far people have come. And knowing that there's this generation out there who's looking at them and just seeing writers. The same way I think, you know, Larry David or whatever drives me crazy and I'm not into it, or Louis C.K. drives me crazy for X amount of reasons, but it's only for who they are, not because they're men.
Right.
So if you're online, check it out. It's a fun little interview, these two ladies going back and forth, but I also think it's a nice moment in internet land.
Wonderful. Wonderful, wonderful. Well, I spoiled a little bit what was making me happy this week. I have been doing some reading this week about a variety of kind of cultural topics, and one of the things that I wound up reading was Linda Obst's book called Sleepless in Hollywood, because she, among other things, produced Sleepless in Seattle and worked a bunch with Nora Ephron. And as you'll find out, if you read the book, wanted to work some more with Nora Ephron and ran into some studio problems, which she details in some fury, I would call it. It is a fascinating book because on the one hand, she is very romantically in love with the kind of studio environment that she worked in, which for a lot of us is still, I mean, her great experience that she talks about how awesome it was making How to Lose a Guy in 10 Days. And for a lot of us, that's not the, you know, that's not exactly the ideal artistic environment either. But what she's saying is, you know, it was in fact done by people who were talking about the script and who you should cast based on what their appeal was. And there's this moment where she contrasts what a casting session would have looked like when she was there. Like, this person's too old. And even if you find it disheartening, it's right. Based on the person. It's like, this person's too old. This person, oh no, I wouldn't sleep with that person. You can't, you know, and it would be kind of grungy and nasty, but it was about the person and the appeal to the audience. She contrasted it with now, those decisions get made by marketing people and distribution people, where somebody comes in and says, well, that guy's good for $500 million in China. You're done. And you can't have the conversation anymore about what are they like and would they be good in the movie and will people want to fall in love with them or whatever. And it's like, it is like a system that would have seemed a little crass already has lost
somehow managed to
the heart it had when it was making How to Lose a Guy in 10 Days.
20 years ago, that heart was going, love, love.
Right. but she did participate in making Sleepless in Seattle and some right. things that are kind of fondly remembered. And so for me, reading her book is very eye-opening, and yet it's you want to read it with the distance of, like, she's got her own ideas about what's romantic. You don't have to kind of embrace all of her notions, because she also sort of talks about, like, how great was it when it was all these, like, power lunches with these, you know, high-level, beautiful people, and now it's just all jerks, you know? And it's kind of, you get the sense that she's very much in it, too. But it is a terrific book and a really good read, and it does contain a lot of truth about the kind of brutality of the business, of the movie business right now, and exactly what you were saying, the squeezing out of middle budget pictures where you can either get like practically no money and raise it all yourself, or you have to be prepared to make $200 million. And if you can't, they don't want any part of it. And so much of it being wrong. I mean, the killer takeaway, I'll just give you one final killer takeaway from this book for me. She talks about the fact that the distribution between overseas and domestic box office for movies used to be approximately, I think she says, 70% domestic and 30% overseas. And now it's more the opposite. And so you're at a point where substantially the majority of the money to be brought in by an American film can be expected to be overseas. And therefore, you know, on average. And therefore, that's what's running the discussion. Anyway, fascinating book, really good. Linda Obst, Sleepless in Hollywood. And I enjoyed it very, very much.
Nice.
And that's what's making me happy this week. And that brings us to the end of our show. You can follow all of us on Twitter. You can follow me at NPR Monkey C. You can follow Stephen at I Dislike Stephen, STEPHEN. You can follow Trey at Trey Graham, Trey with an E, Graham like the cracker. You can follow Audie Cornish, our pal Audie Cornish, at NPR Audie. That's AUDIE. You can follow our absent pal Glenn Weldon at GH Weldon, WELDON. You can follow our producer Nick Fountain at Nick Fountain, Nick like Nick, Fountain like Fountain. And you can follow our esteemed producer emeritus and music director Mike Katziff at Mike Katziff, KATZIF. Mike's band, Hello Come In, provides our in-and-out music, which you are bobbing your head to right now. So thanks so much to all of you guys for being here.
Thank you.
Especially Audie. Thank you so much for visiting us.
Especially Audie?
Absolutely.
What about me?
I paid her to say that.
Yeah. And thanks to all of you for listening, and we will see you back here next week. Thanks for listening to Pop Culture Happy Hour. There are lots of other NPR podcasts, including great interviews, highlights from the week's news, storytelling, and entertainment. Browse them all on iTunes under Podcasts.